Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 11th of June, these are our main stories. The US accuses Hamas of being the only obstacle to a UN-backed American ceasefire proposal for Gaza and insists that Israel does back it. A day after it went missing, it's been confirmed that a plane carrying Malawi's vice president has crashed, killing everyone on board. Also in this podcast, how locals in Tanzania are fighting to preserve coral reefs.
What we have done around Nemba is that we have used natural coral rock as the foundation for artificial reefs. And this mimics the natural reef foundation.
And why even global superstars experience ghosting. But first, a day after the UN Security Council endorsed a US-backed ceasefire proposal for Gaza, America's top diplomat, Antony Blinken, has tried to put the onus directly on Hamas's leader in Gaza, Yahya Sinwar. Speaking after a meeting in Jerusalem with the Israeli Prime Minister, he said Benjamin Netanyahu has assured him of his support for the three-phase proposal, which when unveiled last month by President Biden had been described as an Israeli proposal. But there's growing concern that Mr. Netanyahu's assurance can't be relied on, given his repeated insistence that Israel won't stop fighting until it's eradicated Hamas. Mr. Blinken insisted it was not Israel that was the obstacle, but Hamas.
The United Nations Security Council, in effect speaking for the entire international community, made it as clear as it possibly could be that this is what the world is looking for. 14 votes for, no votes against, something quite rare at the Security Council these days, and I think that speaks volumes too. So everyone's vote is in except for one vote, and that's Hamas, and that's what we wait for.
The militant group has welcomed the UN Security Council resolution but has not given a formal response. Our State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman, is travelling with Mr. Blinken.
Well, the US Secretary of State has reiterated his call for Hamas to accept the ceasefire for hostage release proposal that was outlined 11 days ago now by President Biden. He described there being, in his words, one man hiding 10 stories underground that he said was the last outstanding vote to this proposal going through. And he said it offered some hope that the United Nations Security Council on Monday night passed a resolution backing this particular proposal. But there is still a fundamental issue beneath the surface here, and it's not part of the public presentation around this, but concern among the Americans about keeping the Israeli leadership on board to the extent that it is. That's because Prime Minister Netanyahu has been very lukewarm in his public pronouncements about this ceasefire. Now, Mr. Blinken was asked today, had he had an explicit assurance from Mr. Netanyahu that he would continue support for this ceasefire proposal in the event that Hamas comes back and accepts it. And Mr. Blinken said emphatically yes, that he had had that assurance from the Israeli leader. So I think the Americans feel like there's still momentum in this, but it remains a fact as Mr. Blinken heads for these meetings with Arab leaders and to Qatar on Wednesday. It remains the case there is still no real sign of an imminent breakthrough in this ceasefire proposal.
Tom Bateman. Meanwhile, the Israeli military says four soldiers have been killed in Rafah in southern Gaza. The statement said they died when a building rigged with explosives collapsed. Yoland Nell in Jerusalem told us more about the latest fighting in Gaza.
So if you look at what's been happening in the past day, we've seen more Israeli strikes with sources in hospitals saying that several Palestinians have been killed in the centre of the Gaza Strip where Israel began its new military offensive last week. There's been helicopter gunfire and naval shelling in the north of Gaza and in the centre. And we're hearing about street battles going on still between Hamas fighters, who are also leaving sort of booby-trapped buildings in places like Rafah, where Israel's military offensive continues. People there, the few remaining in Rafah, because really more than a million have fled from that southernmost city. And that's where most of the displaced people of Gaza were just a few weeks ago. And that is where these four Israeli soldiers have been killed, we're told.
Our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell. More than 24 hours after a plane carrying the vice president of Malawi and nine other people went missing while flying over the mountainous forests in the north of the country, it's been confirmed that all on board have died in a crash. The vice president, Salus Chilima, had been leading a delegation that was due to attend a funeral. In a televised address to the nation, Malawi's president, Lazarus Chakwera, said wreckage had been found in a forest.
The search and rescue team has found the aircraft, and they have found it completely destroyed with no survivors, as all passengers on board were killed on impact. Words cannot describe how heartbreaking this is, and I can only imagine how much pain and anguish you all must be feeling at this time.
Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, told us more.
Footage from the scene shows the sides of a fairly mountainous area close to forests, extremely foggy, and that seems to have been the problem here. The search did take a long time until it found the plane because of the fog and also the fact that it was quite a forested area. And we now understand that Mr. Chilima's remains and the remains of the other nine passengers are going to be taken to the capital, Lilongwe, and Malawians are waiting to hear news of a funeral. But as you could hear from the president, Lazarus Chakwera's voice there, you know, he was in a very somber mood. And then there was footage of him consoling other politicians, some of whom were wiping away tears as he was moving past them. But a great deal of shock in Malawi.
And tell us more about Mr. Chilima. I think he'd been seen as a future president, potentially.
Well, it was reported that he was likely to run for president next year against Mr. Chakwera. Interestingly, he used to work in the private sector for various businesses. And then after entering politics, he twice served as vice president. And it was actually the teaming up between his party and the current president's party that led to the ousting of the former president. But then corruption allegations surfaced, and Mr. Chilima, who denied any wrongdoing throughout, was at the centre of a very long corruption allegation that was recently dropped. And now we're expecting to hear news of a funeral.
Will Ross. At the latest international donor conference to rebuild Ukraine, the German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, has promised to support Kyiv for as long as necessary. Mr. Scholz told the audience in Berlin, which included President Zelensky, that everything possible needed to be done to boost Ukraine's air defences and that the war would only end with Kyiv's victory.
What Ukraine's military most urgently needs are ammunition and weapons, especially air defense. And I would like to urge everyone here today to support our initiative to strengthen the Ukrainian air defense with everything.
Mr. Scholz also rallied private companies to put their money into rebuilding Ukraine. Our Berlin correspondent Damian McGuinness told us more about the delegates' response.
The challenge is really, how do you rebuild a country when it's still being destroyed by Russian attacks? And that is really one of the main questions, you know, overhanging this conference. I think there are a couple of different strands of attack here, if you like. On the one hand, it's about restoring straight away, where possible, the infrastructure for humanitarian survival. And so you're talking about restoring energy infrastructure that's been destroyed, or making sure people have clean water, you know, really basic stuff that is making life very difficult for Ukrainians. And then, of course, you have other forms of infrastructure, such as schools and internet and all the things that you need to make sure the economy keeps going. But there's a broader question about what to do later. And I think what the conference, what all the donors and what all the government heads and leaders here are saying is that it's really important to get business involved. So what this really is about, it's sort of like a platform for leaders to profile themselves and say, our country's giving so and so many billions and our country's doing this, and to say how much they're doing to support Ukraine. But the real point of this conference is to say to business leaders, no, we are supporting Ukraine politically. Now, this is a good business opportunity for you for the future, and we need you to invest in Ukraine, to have faith in Ukraine, to get the economy going after the war's finished.
And Germany is the second biggest supplier of military help after the US to Ukraine. This appeal for air defence, this is going to be music to Mr. Zelensky's ears.
Yeah, and I think what we've seen is a remarkable turnaround in Germany. Until Russia's full invasion of Ukraine, the whole of German foreign policy and energy policy was essentially based on engaging Russia, getting energy from Russia, and trade with Russia was meant to keep Russia on side. With the full invasion of Ukraine, the government saw a complete turnaround. The problem is, or the difficulty is, getting all voters on side, because a lot of voters are very uncomfortable with what they would see as a big militarisation of society. A lot of services in Germany are increasingly strapped for cash, so, you know, there's a lot of wrangling about budgets here. And so some people are saying, well, you know, why are we spending so much money on arms when we can't even keep schools open properly? So that is a debate domestically, but I think the political mainstream and the most centrist voters and most mainstream voters do wholeheartedly support Ukraine, but it is about keeping that support on side. And it's a big election issue. You know, we've got federal elections next year. We just had the European Union Parliament elections. And this question of what to do about Russia's invasion of Ukraine is a live election issue for voters here. It's a controversial one. And it is something that certainly the far-right AfD is tapping into, saying, well, you know, we're just fueling this war and we should buy Russian energy again. So it's a controversial issue, but one that's really, I think it's fair to say, that mainstream partisan voters are still full on behind supporting Ukraine.
Damian McGuinness in Berlin. 3 weeks ago, a man died and dozens of other passengers were injured when a Singapore Airlines plane hit turbulence and dropped more than 50 metres in just 4 seconds. Now the airline has offered compensation of $10,000 to each passenger who suffered minor injuries. Those who were more seriously hurt have been offered an initial payment of more than double that sum, as Nick Marsh reports.
Singapore Airlines hasn't yet responded to the BBC's inquiry about exactly how many people will be entitled to the $10,000 payment. But more than 100 people were treated in hospital after the flight was safely diverted to Bangkok last month. The airline says that those passengers who suffered more serious injuries have been offered an advanced payment of $25,000 with a view to a personally negotiated settlement.
Nick Marsh. Judges from Britain, Canada and Australia have continued to sit on Hong Kong's top court since the handover to China in 1997. But in the last few days, Jonathan Sumption, a former British Supreme Court justice, has stepped down from the role along with a colleague. It was in the wake of the conviction of 14 pro-democracy activists. Since 2020, Hong Kong has seen a crackdown on those who support democracy, as a sweeping national security law has come into force in response to mass protests. The judge told the BBC that the rule of law in Hong Kong had been profoundly compromised by China.
I think that the picture is getting darker. The judgment on the 30th of May against the 14 democracy activists was a major indication of the lengths to which some judges are prepared to go to ensure that Beijing's campaign against those who have supported democracy succeeds.
Well, that's provoked this strong response from the Chinese territory's chief executive, John Lee.
In 2021, Lord Sumption refused to take part in a political boycott orchestrated in the UK. And he said then that people should not confuse rule of law with democracy. His recent statement looks to me to be contradictory to his previous stance in this regard.
I spoke to our Asia Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow, who began by explaining why a British judge was in Hong Kong in the first place.
It seems odd, doesn't it? But essentially, it's a hangover from when Hong Kong was a British colony. Hong Kong's legal system is based on the British system, the common law system. And judges from common law jurisdictions, Britain, Australia and Canada, used to sit on Hong Kong courts. Indeed, they still do on the Hong Kong Court of Final Appeal. There are seven judges from abroad who sit on that court still. So that's what they're doing there. Also, it's because Hong Kong is an international city and it gave the place an international flavour. What Lord Sumption has said, and what you heard him say there, was that essentially over the last few years, the situation facing judges and the legal system in Hong Kong has completely changed. A lot more political pressure on them. And so that's why he decided last week he could no longer lend his name and his esteem to that system and resigned, as other foreign judges have done also.
And not surprisingly, the Chinese response has been quite sharp.
It has been quite sharp. You heard there John Lee, the leader of Hong Kong, essentially rebutting Jonathan Sumption's position. Essentially, Mr. Lee believes that the Hong Kong legal system remains completely independent and outside of political interference. That's stretching things quite a lot. I think on the broader point that Jonathan Sumption made, that being major changes in Hong Kong, and Jonathan Sumption said that actually the territory is moving towards totalitarianism. There's lots of evidence to back that up over the last 5 years because of the introduction of the national security law. People just haven't been able to speak as freely as before. Also on a narrower point, where the judiciary is being interfered with, I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that as well. As Lord Sumption says, judges in Hong Kong have nowhere else to go and they come under a lot of pressure from the media, from Chinese politicians to deliver verdicts that the Chinese leader wants. So it's a lot of evidence to back up what Jonathan Sumption has been saying.
Mickey Bristow. Still to come on this podcast, elephants can remember the sound of individual members of their herd. You're listening to the Global News Podcast. About 1 million Rohingya refugees have fled persecution in Myanmar to seek refuge across the border in Bangladesh. They've been living in crowded camps there for years, many of them injured or deeply traumatised by the Burmese military's campaign of violence against them. But now they also face problems from within. Tensions between rival groups in the camps have been rising, and Bangladeshi police say following a clash in one refugee centre, at least 3 Rohingya refugees have been killed and 7 others injured. Our South Asia regional editor, Ambarasa Natarajan, told us more.
The security situation inside these Rohingya camps has been worsening in the past few months because of fighting between armed groups from the Rohingya community itself. You know, these camps are scattered in the district of Cox's Bazar along the border with the Myanmar. In fact, the Bangladeshi police, they do not go inside late in the nights or even in small numbers because of the worsening security. Now, according to the Bangladeshi police, more than 100 members of the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army people, they broke through the fence and they attacked those who were patrolling the camps in the night. And as a result, 3 people were killed and 7 others were injured. Now, this also highlights how bad the situation is for many people. Describe that as this is really like hell because we escaped from the alleged atrocities of the Burmese military. Now we are being killed by our own people. And it also is linked to the situation, what's happening in Myanmar. And that is one of the reasons why the violence is also increasing here.
Because some of these Rohingya are being forcibly recruited to fight in that civil war in Myanmar.
In Myanmar, the armed groups opposed to the military regime there, they have been fighting, they have been taking over many of the border posts along the Bangladesh-Myanmar border. Arakan Rohingya rebels feel that this is the time for them to launch their own attacks against the Burmese military because the Burmese military has lost control in some of the Rohingya areas on the other side of the border. So what some of the residents are saying is that they come here, forcefully take teenage boys and men, and they also, you know, induce them by money. They come in the night. And there are fears that more than 1,000 people possibly could have been recruited from these camps. And that is why many parents are trying to protect their sons, and they borrow money from various agencies, from the relatives, so that they can at least go abroad. And that is the situation they are facing at the moment.
Ambrosan Etirajan. There are only 3 days left until the new South African Parliament meets to elect the next president. With the governing African National Congress failing to secure an outright majority for the first time since democracy was established 30 years ago, South Africans are waiting to see if their parliament can produce a coalition government. But apart from tricky negotiations, there's also the problem of the recently formed MK party of the former president Jacob Zuma, which doesn't want the session to go ahead at all. Our correspondent in Johannesburg, Nomsa Maseko, told Victoria Uwankunda more about that.
The Mkhonto we Sizwe party, led by the former president Jacob Zuma, have said that they plan to interdict parliament to ensure that Friday's sitting does not take place. And political analysts have said that only the Constitutional Court can do that. However, the Chief Justice of South Africa, Raymond Zondo, has said that the sitting in Parliament will take place on Friday, where the Speaker of Parliament will be elected, as well as the Deputy President and the President. However, this is the first time that the ANC does not have a majority, you know, in Parliament, where they do not need the support of opposition parties to elect Cyril Ramaphosa as president. So these secret behind-closed-door meetings are probably going to help the ANC to ensure that Cyril Ramaphosa is elected president on Friday.
So what then are we looking in terms of scenario? Are we looking at MK's MPs not showing up on Friday, their very first day being in Parliament?
Well, Umkhonto we Sizwe MPs have said that they will not go to Parliament to sit and elect a president because they believe that the elections were a sham that does not represent the will of the people. However, the MK has also not come forward with evidence of vote rigging, as they had said that they will take it to court to ensure that Parliament does not sit. So South Africans want to know, what is it that Mkhonto we Sizwe has? What kind of evidence do they have to prove that the election was fraud? And as a result, it looks like, you know, the majority of political parties, particularly those that have been elected, will go to Parliament on Friday, and there will be that election of the Speaker, the Deputy and the President.
So what is the best case scenario here for Cyril Ramaphosa, the President and ANC, in terms of forging ahead? Who are we looking at with them making a deal or coalition with?
The ANC has proposed a government of national unity, where it has been trying to, you know, invite all kinds of political parties, all of them that are represented in Parliament. There have been a lot of behind closed door meetings, told that negotiations are at a very sensitive stage because they also include the sharing of cabinet positions. At the same time, not everyone in the ANC has agreed that the former liberation movement form a partnership with the Democratic Alliance, because some ANC insiders believe a partnership with the DA would be seen as a betrayal to its supporters. And as a result, the internal dissent is intensifying.
Nomsa Maseko in South Africa. Now, we humans like talking to friends and family, but we're not alone. That is the sound of an elephant. It may seem to be just low rumbling, but scientists in Kenya say they've discovered that wild elephants call their family and other members of the herd that they're close to by specific names and respond enthusiastically when they're called by another elephant they know well. Francis Reed reports.
In Samburu National Reserve in northern Kenya, scientists studied herds of wild elephants. They found the noises the animals made included a range of complex information, not just emotion, but also names for each other. Mickey Pardo led the research.
They're called rumbles. And, you know, when most people think of elephant calls, they probably think of trumpets, which are sort of the iconic sound that elephants make. But actually, trumpets are much less common than rumbles. One of the interesting things about these calls is they're so low frequency that most speakers can't reproduce them, because the human ear can't detect all of it. It sounds kind of something like, it's just this rumbling, low-pitched vocalization.
When the scientists played to an elephant a recording of their friend or family member calling out their name, the animal called back or approached the speaker. But the same elephant was far less enthusiastic when played the names of others. The researchers say that when names were called out, it was often adults addressing young elephants over a long distance. And by using machine learning, the researchers were able to decipher the patterns in the animal's calls.
There's been kind of a proliferation of interest recently in using machine learning to help us understand animal communication. Using it to try to figure out if animals have names for each other is kind of a novel application of it, I think.
Parrots and dolphins are already known to identify each other by mimicking each other's calls, and some species of bats can use specific calls to others. But elephants are the first non-human species found to use names that can be understood. Scientists say the research could have significant implications for our understanding of the way elephants think and the social bonds they form.
Gives a new meaning to the phrase trunk call, that report by Francis Reed. To Tanzania now, and the coral reef surrounding Nemba Island in the Zanzibar archipelago is under threat from warmer sea temperatures, illegal fishing and damage from tourism. Now locals have come up with an ingenious solution to preserve both the reef and their own livelihoods. Alfred Lastek reports from Zanzibar.
In Nemba Island, a Eden oasis off the northeast coast of Zanzibar, several ocean rangers dive deep into the sapphire waters. The divers are part of a team to restore the island's famous coral reef, known as one of the most important nature reserves in East Africa. Over the years, the coral reef has reduced its cover by 55%.
Initially, the area faced significant pressure from tourism.
Bakari Ja is the coordinator of African Foundation Zanzibar.
With 200 boats carrying at least 400 guests entering an area of only 200 square meters simultaneously.
In September 2021, local communities began collaborating with And Beyond, a non-profit responsible tourism organization, and African Foundation to repair the reef, protect the marine conservation area, and support sustainable fishing.
We have witnessed corals regenerating, even at significant depth. We have successfully restored damaged corals by 80%.
Nemba's coral reef has been damaged in part due to warmer temperatures, which cause the corals to expel the algae that gives them the colors turning them white, also known as coral bleaching. Artificial reefs are seen as one way to counter this, but using the right material is vital to their success.
When artificial reefs were in their infancy, people used the wrong materials, like dumping tires to try and create artificial reefs, which is not the right approach.
Dr. Camilla Flores is the program manager and principal scientist at Oceans Without Borders, who has been working on the project in Nemba.
What we have done around Nemba is that we have used natural coral rock as the foundation for artificial reefs. And this mimics the natural reef foundation.
The project is also educating the local community on how to protect the coral reefs. Harmful fishing practices in the past contributed to the reef damage.
We have seen positive changes. Illegal practices like the use of bombs have decreased, and the fishermen have become more knowledgeable about sustainable fishing methods.
Nemba's coral reef is also crucial to Zanzibar's local economy. Dr. Makame Omar is the director of Zanzibar Marine Department.
Coral has got very important position to play in the development of a blue economy. Currently, we managed to demarcate 14 coral-rich areas in both Pemba and the Unguja. Out of 14, up to this moment, we managed to put demarcation buoys for 7 out of 14 and increase awareness to fishermen that these areas are now a replenished zone no fishing activities allowed, to give chance for the coral to rejuvenate, to replenish.
But in the face of relentless climate change, the long-term viability of artificial reef is uncertain. Some argue that to really protect the coral, mitigating climate change is the only long-term solution.
Alfred Lastic in Zanzibar. No one likes to be rejected, or in modern parlance, ghosted. That's when someone very close to you, a lover, a family member or a friend, cuts off all communication without any explanation. Sometimes when you thought you were getting on well with each other. And in the age of dating apps and social media, this kind of practice is becoming increasingly common. So much so that not even global superstars are immune from it. This report by Alfie Habishan.
I had a crazy ghosting. It was insane. It was like somebody that I'd also known for years. And
that's the American singer Billie Eilish. She's got 9 Grammy Awards, multiple number one hits, and millions of delirious fans who call themselves the Avocados. But she's not safe from a ghosting. So then who is? Almost one-third of Americans say they've been victim to that stinging feeling. And we always think it's personal. It's surely to do with the fact that there is something terrible about you that no one is willing to share with you, or that your lover has suddenly fallen in love with someone else they just walk past in the street. But experts say it's really not to do with you at all, and that it's the new normal in dating, brought on by the social isolation people have experienced during COVID. But are they just trying to make us feel better about being rejected? Here's an explanation from someone who's actually dished out a dreaded ghosting.
I know people demonise us, but we're not bad people. I think the majority of people that ghost don't do it out of malicious intent. I think it's because, well, in my case anyway, it's just cowardice. We're scared. Scared to have a real connection with someone. I've missed out on so many potential friendships, like love interests. I've even ghosted family members simply because of cowardice.
But surely it's not always so dramatic. Don't we just sometimes forget to address the never-ending stream of messages and emails that we are confronted with every day? Well, that's my excuse anyway. And anything that brings a millionaire superstar back down to earth might not be a bad thing.
Alfie Habishan. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Jack Wilfan. The producer was Oliver Berlau. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time. Goodbye.